Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, September 11th, 2019. Another dark anniversary of the events of September 11th, 2001. And the cover-up, which continues to befuddle many Americans. It's embraced by the corporate media, largely unchallenged. And our political leaders have no courage to demand a new investigation and really get to the bottom of what occurred 18 years ago today. And on this dark anniversary, I always like to recap my position to clarify for people, because there are many who challenge the 9/11 official narrative, and some are crackpots. There's no question about that. And the people who created the official narrative like to find a crackpot and then, with a broad brush, say that anyone who challenges the official narrative of 9/11 is one of those crackpots. So, here is my story, all right? I have been investigating 9/11 since it happened. I personally attended several days of the 9/11 Commission hearings in Washington, D.C., and I will recount for you my witnessing of the slippery testimony of one Donald Rumsfeld, who was the Secretary of Defense on 9/11. But I know in my bones that the 9/11 Commission conducted a cover-up. And Governor Kaine, Congressman Hamilton, the co-chairs of that commission, they now admit they were lied to. They didn't get the full story. But the media doesn't care. And when we look at the incredible arc of dark deeds, bad decisions, elective wars that we have engaged in since 9/11, it is very hard to watch my fellow citizens accept the official story, fall in line, accept the surveillance state, the police state that has been erected since then to, quote unquote, keep us safe. And so this is one of those episodes that, while it initially united Americans, it continues to divide us. Fundamentally, our government has lied to us. We mostly know that. But many people prefer denial to actually trying to understand what happened, who did it, and why. And so, 18 years on, we continue to be at war in Afghanistan. We still have some troops in Iraq. We've expanded our imperialist footprint in the region. Much of that was part of the plan for a new American century. That was the think tank of neocons that got together in 98 and 99. And it's very clear that Bush was ready to implement their blueprint when 9/11 provided the excuse, at minimum, to embark on regime change adventures. Many people ask me, well, what's new about 9/11? Well, there is some new information, new investigations, new research. And as I tipped listeners a week or so ago, Richard Gage and the dedicated team at Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth have been working for 4 years with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Engineering Department, and they have released their draft report. And the principal conclusion, quoting, of our study is that fire did not cause the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7 on 9/11, contrary to the conclusions of NIST, that's the National Institute of Standards and Technology, that was used to whitewash and to support the cover-up. And also it's contrary to the conclusions of private engineering firms that studied the collapse of Building 7. Now, perhaps you've never focused on Building 7. To me, it's the easiest way to engage people in a discussion about what's wrong with the official narrative, because the 9/11 Commission just breezed right past the collapse of Building 7. It fell in less than 10 seconds at 5:20 in the afternoon, hadn't been hit by an airplane. There were some fires inside the building. But the fires did not go above the 13th floor. And it takes denial of fundamental physics for a group like NIST to claim, oh, well, you know, the fires led to just a sequential collapse of the building, just like we say happened with Trade Center Building 1 and Building 2. Well, in the careful language of engineers, they conclude that fires could not have caused weakening or displacement of structural members capable of initiating any of the hypothetical local failures alleged to have triggered the total collapse of the building, nor could any local failures, even if they had occurred, have triggered a sequence of failures that would have resulted in the observed total collapse. And their secondary conclusion is that the collapse of Building 7 was a global failure, quote, involving the near simultaneous failure of every column in the building, end quote. Now, as I scratch my bald head here, you can scratch anything you want. But what does this actually mean? If every column in the building collapsed in a near simultaneous fashion? Well, it's a demolition. I defy you. I encourage you. I dare you. I bet you. If you can tell me another way that every column in the building would have collapsed at almost the same time in a free fall gravity method, I'd like to hear it. Now, the corporate media is not talking about this. You have to go to independent media outlets to learn about it. I'm going to be talking about this tonight. I'll be reporting on it at the 9/11 Truth Film Festival. It's an annual event. I've only missed one or two when I was out of town. Happens every year at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, California. One of the other reports that I'm going to make at the event tonight, I have reported on previously here at the podcast, and that is that the little town of Munson, it's actually a fire district called the Franklin Square and Munson Fire District. They're in suburban New York, and they lost one of their members who died at the World Trade Center on September 11th. And they have written a resolution that was passed by their district board. The overwhelming evidence presented in the petition demonstrates beyond any doubt that pre-planted explosives and or incendiaries, not just airplanes and the ensuing fires, caused the destruction of the three World Trade Center buildings, killing the vast majority of the victims who perished that day. The victims of 9/11, their families, the people of New York City, and our nation deserve that every crime related to the attacks of September 11 be investigated to the fullest, and that every person who was responsible face justice. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Fire Commissioners of the Franklin Square and Munson Fire District fully supports a comprehensive federal grand jury investigation and prosecution of every crime related to the attacks of September 11, as well as any and all efforts by other government entities to investigate and uncover the full truth surrounding the events of that horrible day. And as you know, may know, in New York, the Lawyers Committee for a 9/11 inquiry have made progress, gotten the district attorney to acknowledge that there's a basis for their claims and for their legal process. So we are continuing to fight to get some truth, if not the whole truth, about 9/11. And I find it interesting as I look at mainstream media today. Here's The Guardian. And they have what's kind of balanced article here. Headline, New York firefighters recall 9/11 victims. Some support talks between the U.S. and leaders of the Taliban. Others question the timing and wisdom of the meeting. But midway through the article, they cite Rosaline Talon, who lost her brother, a firefighter, on 9/11. And she is a party to a lawsuit alleging that the Saudi government employees knowingly assisted the plot The U.S. was not really getting at 9/11, and she is quoted as saying, "That makes my blood boil." So I think this is important because in between the coverage that cements the official narrative and the cover-up, we do see a little, you know, a little bit of light streaming in there of people asking the right questions. And here's one in a mainstream media outlet, Paul Sperry, in the New York Post, published on September 7th. And he nails St. Bob Mueller, who was the FBI director who led a cover-up, who blocked investigations, destroyed evidence, all related to the attempt to investigate the Saudi family in South Florida that abruptly packed up and left just a couple of days before 9/11. And Mr. Sperry writes, as the head of the FBI at the time, Mueller was not nearly as interested in investigating the espionage conspiracy involving the Saudis, which also involved foreign intelligence officers. Far from it. The record shows he covered up evidence pointing back to the Saudi embassy in Riyadh and may have even misled Congress about what he knew. He quotes 9/11 victim survivor Sharon Primoli, who was pulled from the rubble of the WTC. He was the master when it came to covering up the kingdom's role in 9/11. And she continued, in October of 01, Mueller shut down the government's investigation after only 3 weeks and then took part in the Bush administration's campaign to block, obfuscate, and generally stop anything about Saudi Arabia from being released. Back to the voice of the newspaper reporter, Sperry. In fact, Mueller threw up roadblocks in the path of his own investigators working the 9/11 case while making it easier for Saudi suspects to escape questioning, according to multiple agents. Time and again, agents were called off from pursuing leads back to the kingdom's embassy in Washington, as well as its consulate in L.A., where former FBI agent Stephen Moore headed a 9/11 task force looking into local contacts. And you know about the hijackers who were hanging out in San Diego, going to flight schools. Agent Moore concluded that diplomatic and intelligence personnel of Saudi Arabia knowingly provided material support to the two hijackers and facilitated the 9/11 plot. But he wasn't allowed to interview them. In Washington, former FBI agent John Guandolo, who worked the terror cases out of the Washington office, said that at the time, the Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Prince Bandar, should have been treated as a terrorist suspect for giving money to a woman who funded two of the hijackers. Mueller obliged what Guandolo called an outrageous request from Bandar within days of the attacks to help evacuate dozens of Saudi officials. We remember that. In 2002, Mueller prevented agents from arresting a Saudi-sponsored al-Qaeda cleric, that's Anwar al-Awlaki. Now, I've got problems with Obama's ordering of the drone strike death of al-Awlaki, an American citizen. But the way he was handled prior to his escape or his exile in Yemen raises a hell of a lot of questions. A couple more points here. Mueller removed a veteran agent from investigating a tip that an advisor to the Saudi royal family had met with some of the hijackers at the home in Sarasota, Florida. And I want to single out Senator Bob Graham, now retired. He's given me 3 or 4 interviews over the last 10 or 15 years, and he's extremely careful because he is still bound. He was chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. He is bound by the secrecy agreements that he embraced. But he has dedicated himself and put a lot of effort in trying to expose that 28-page memo. And then when it was released with redactions, he pressed to expose the redactions. And yes, he is constrained and often very careful. But Bob Graham knows bullshit when he smells it, and he smells a lot of it in the official narrative of 9/11. Now, there's one other report related to the Saudis I want to recommend to you from my friend and colleague, Russ Baker. Now, he, of course, has studied the Bush family. He wrote a whole book about them. And he is a dedicated guy who follows the facts, a hard-nosed journalist, in my opinion. And he writes about the Florida Bulldog, this nonprofit online news site in South Florida that has been dogging the Sarasota story for a long time. And Who What Why conducted its own investigation, discovering a direct link between a man named Isam Ghazawi, who was the father-in-law of the family that fled South Florida. Ghazawi served as the director of IRAD Management, the division of IRAD Trading, which holds, holds the Saudi franchise for many multinational brands, and it also manages facilities for members of the Saudi royal family. So Baker traces this Ghazawi, is that right? Yeah. Ghazawi, my apology, and says that this company, IRAD, identifies Ghazawi as the executive managing director, and a crown prince sultan is the chairman. So the link between them reopens questions about the Bush White House's controversial approval of those charter flights that allowed about some 40 or so Saudis to escape the United States during the time when airspace was closed. All commercial flights had been shut down. I was outside the country, and we were concerned we wouldn't be able to get back. Anyway, I recommend the piece by Russ Baker. It shows that the cover-up continues, that the FBI has been a part of it, and that they continue to aggressively protect the cover-up and the secrets that they sit on and have been sitting on for a long time. I really appreciate the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast, and not all of you agree with me in my skepticism of the official story of 9/11. And I appreciate that those of you who are not in alignment with me continue to support my skepticism and my honest reporting of it. And so I encourage you to support my work with a subscription. People like Faith Peoples, Diane Morris Leonard in Maine, Paul Tomaselli, and let's see who's on my list also today, Alice Carlson. They kick in $5, $10, $20 a month, and you can do it too. All you have to do is visit peterbcollins.com. You'll find the menu button, then click on Become a Subscriber. You hit the sign-up page, and you can choose a PayPal subscription of $5, $10, $20 a month. Our $50 annual subscription earns you a bonus book. I've got Bush, Trump on the couch. I used to have Bush on my couch. And I also have a copy of... one more copy of 2100 Dystopian Utopia. So grab it while you can. And if you prefer to avoid PayPal, use the U.S. mail. My P.O. box is number 150-660, San Rafael, California, 94915. So about a week ago, I was over at Politico, and I saw this article, which is tagged as History Department. And it's a picture of Dick Cheney and a quote, "We may have to shoot down this aircraft." And it turns out it's a book excerpt from a new book called The Only Plane in the Sky, An Oral History of 9/11, written by Garrett Graff. And as I read it, I found it fascinating because it takes you through on a timeline basis, starting at about 9 a.m., what was going on in the Situation Room and in the emergency bunker where Dick Cheney took control of things on 9/11, while George W. Bush was being flown around the country in Air Force One. And it's a fascinating read. You get the feel of the room, and it takes you right up to the point of about 10 o'clock, when Dick Cheney clearly issued an order to shoot down Flight 93. That's the one that went down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and was believed to be inbound to attack Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, or the White House were presumed to be the targets. So in this narrative, they go into detail and they relate what I have told you about before, that Dick Cheney gave a clear order to shoot down Flight 93 at about 10 a.m. on September 11th. Here's a quote. This is attributed to Commander Anthony Barnes. He says, the Pentagon thought there was another hijacked plane, and they were asking for permission to shoot down an identified hijacked commercial aircraft. I asked the vice president that question. He answered it in the affirmative. I asked again to be sure. Sir, I am confirming that you have given permission? Without hesitation, in the affirmative, he said, any confirmed hijacked plane may be engaged and shot down. Then they shift to italics. They say the scrambled fighter jets would never make contact with Flight 93. The passengers and crew aboard the flight were planning at the same time to take down the plane themselves. Now, I think this article was factual until they went to the italics. And I know the story of heroic daring do by the passengers with those beverage carts ramming the cockpit door. The cell phone calls that technologically were not possible in 2001, where we heard the, difficult conversations that people had with loved ones like Tom Burnett and his mom, Dina, when he called and said, "Mom, this is Tom Burnett." How many people call their mom and use their full name? That's just one example of what I consider to be the fictional accounts that were created to cover up the shootdown of Flight 93. And I've told you before that I have direct information from a high-ranking national security officer who was on the most secure communications link on 9/11 and confirms that the order was given to shoot down Flight 93. Now, I don't have evidence that it actually occurred. But when you look at the debris field in Shanksville, I think it's pretty obvious that it wasn't a skirmish in the cockpit that led the plane to crash, because there would be debris. There would be remnants of that aircraft and of the people aboard. The coroner who arrived at the scene found nothing. No human remains. And I believe that the shoot-down order was executed. The Washington Post rewriting history with a story today about the heroics of Donald Rumsfeld on 9/11. How the Secretary of Defense was at the Pentagon, watched the TV of the jets hitting the World Trade Center. Then the Pentagon shook, and Rumsfeld, according to this account, raced through smoke and jet fuel fumes to reach the crash site. He was there on the scene. The account says that he helped some people who were bloody. He picked up an airplane part. And that over at the White House, they thought that Rumsfeld had been hit in the attack. They considered him missing. And here's a quote from a cop at the Pentagon. "He was like the captain going down with the ship." Now, these facts, this sequence of events, may be true. But Don Rumsfeld reordered the protocols in May of 2001 related to who had the authority to order jet scrambled and interception and shoot down of attacking aircraft. Used to be the Secretary of Defense and two generals had the independent authority to make that call. But he rewrote the rules, and only he had that authority. And I remember so vividly being in the hearing room when Rumsfeld testified before the 9/11 Commission. And I could not believe the way he dodged the questions. He was just so casual as he ran out the clock. And he was asked by who was perhaps the only commissioner with any balls, Richard Benveniste, "Did you order jets scrambled to protect the Pentagon on the morning of 9/11? Rumsfeld looked at him and kind of rolled his eyes. And then he repeated the question. He said, "Did I order jets scrambled on the morning of 9/11 to protect the Pentagon?" And then Chairman Kaine pounded his gavel a couple of times, said, "Time's up. Next question." And that was the way that the cover-up was enabled. Sure, Rumsfeld was asked a question, but he didn't have to answer it. The official report of the 9/11 Commission is riddled with incomplete information, with critical info that was consigned to footnotes. And that cover-up has held successfully, lo, these many years. And Whitney Webb, who's an amazing, prolific writer at Mint Press, she's up with a piece today on September 11th, and she recites some of the information I told you about the Franklin Square and Munson Fire District resolution, about the new report on Building 7, and she also adds some polling information that was released just yesterday by the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. And while many people are still not aware that Building 7 came down under these curious circumstances on the afternoon of September 11th, 52% of those who saw the footage were either sure or suspected the building's fall was due to explosives and was a controlled demolition. 52%. 27% said they didn't know what to make of it, and only 21% agreed with the official story that the building collapsed due to fires. Before seeing the footage, 36% of respondents said they were unaware that the third building collapsed on September 11th, and 67% were unable to name that building. And another finding of the same poll, was that 48% of respondents support a new investigation into the events of 9/11. And I commend Webb as she closes her piece with this. 18 years after the September 11 attacks, questioning the official government narrative of the events of those days still remains taboo for many, as merely asking questions or calling for a new investigation into one of the most important events in American history, or recent American history, frequently results in derision and dismissal. And she goes on to say that the dominant forces in the American media and the U.S. government have successfully convinced many Americans that doing so, questioning it, is not only dangerous, but irrational and un-American. As evidence continues to mount that the official narrative itself is the irrational narrative, it becomes ever more clear that the reason for this media campaign is to prevent legitimate questions about that day from receiving the scrutiny they deserve, even smearing victims' families and ailing first responders to do so. For too long, never forget has been nearly synonymous with never question. Now, I want to close by noting that as I have aired the questions, exposed the skepticism, challenged the official narrative, people have called me a tin hat conspiracy theorist. I am a person who is dedicated to exposing cover-ups. And a necessary byproduct of those efforts is you have to explore alternate scenarios. And in doing so, that makes you vulnerable to being tagged as a conspiracy theorist. But I think we know that it is the official narrative that is a conspiracy theory. It's riddled with holes, contradictions, and evidence that doesn't add up. And so we must have the courage and the perseverance to weather the catcalls and the fake challenges and continue to push for the truth about 9/11. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.